Just a few years ago, the whole nation was white-knuckled, hand-in-hand, barracking for the Matildas. Tilly fever had the whole country sweating on women's soccer, and it wasn't just a vibe, the numbers backed it up. Their World Cup semi-final match shattered TV ratings records. But now the dust has settled, how's support for women's leagues in Australia holding up? Because critics say poor infrastructure, ill-informed leadership and bad media coverage are stifling growth, with flow-on effects hitting community sport at the grassroots level. So what's the solution? Well, I'm joined now by a former Tilly. Moya Dodd is the former vice-captain of the Matildas and current secretary to the board of the Women's League Forum. Moya, welcome to Life Matters.
G'day, thanks for having me.
Tell me about the role of the Women's League Forum.
Oh, the Women's Leagues Forum convenes the emerging professional women's football leagues around the world, and we share best practice and gather common interests and advocate to stakeholders to help grow the leagues.
Do we need to be thinking about sport as a business in a different way when we're looking at women's leagues and trying to compare them to men's sports?
I think historically women's sport has been thought of as a kind of add-on, as a poor relation to men's sport, but it's now emerging very much in its own right as a commercially valuable and viable proposition. I mean, there's still plenty to do, but there are some extraordinary examples of growth and success from around the world, particularly in women's football, where, for example, the US League, the NWSL, had an astronomical valuation growth in its clubs. The last club that changed hands was Angel City for $250 million. It didn't exist 6 years ago. And their last broadcast deal was 40 times the size of its previous one. It's now on $60 million a year. So these sorts of examples show what can be achieved if there is a focus on the women's game and if the right expertise is brought to bear.
So it's interesting you're talking about TV figures there, because I mentioned at the beginning that figure of the Tilly smashing TV ratings records. How does coverage of a sport translate to fan engagement?
Oh, well, the coverage feeds the fan engagement, of course. I mean, historically, fans of women's sport couldn't just turn on the telly and switch channels and, you know, find a good women's game happening somewhere. They'd have to go hunting for it online. They'd be getting their information off digital media. So they're very digitally native, actually, the fans of women's sport, which makes them more valuable. But I think that where traditional media can do better is by, well, firstly, covering it, because so little of traditional media coverage is devoted to women's sport. But secondly, speaking to the new fans of the sport. I mean, there are so many new fans of women's football and of women's sport in Australia who've emerged over the last 5 years or so. They need to be spoken to in a way that's not necessarily the same as, you know, commentary of men's sport has been conducted for years. There was a really interesting study in the UK, actually, after the last World Cups, and they measured how many people watched the Men's World Cup in Qatar, and they got to about 50 million in the UK. Then they looked at how many watched the Women's World Cup in Australia and New Zealand, and they got to about 30 million. And of those 30 million, about 20 million were overlaps with people who'd watched the Men's World Cup. But incredibly, there were more than 11 million people in the UK who watched the Women's World Cup who did not watch the Men's World Cup. Now, I wouldn't have thought you could find more than half a dozen POMs who liked football and hadn't watched the Men's World Cup, but there they were, 11 million new football supporters who watched the women's and didn't watch the men's.
You're saying we need to talk to people differently or commentate differently. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think if you go to a women's sport event, you feel a different vibe. I mean, I think with every sporting event, fans go to watch a great sporting spectacle. They want to see, you know, big goals, flying tackles. They want to see all the sporting excellence that they, you know, have come to expect from professional athletes. But I think with women's sport, there are other dimensions that are really important as well. People come to celebrate what they think women's sport stands for. And those things are gender equality, they are women's empowerment, and it's a sense of social inclusion. I mean, people often comment about how safe they feel at a women's sport event. They feel welcome. They don't feel like they'll be ridiculed if they sort of shout the wrong thing. There's almost never any violence or, racism or terrible things being shouted from the terraces. In women's sport, that is so rare. It's almost like a new, it's sort of sport without the ugly bits, if I can put it that way.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. And we're talking about women's sport and why some leagues seem to have really be thriving and getting some great deals and lots of fan engagement and others not so much. I'm also joined by Hans Vesterbeek, who's a professor of international sport business at Victoria University. Hans, you've looked at TV ratings compared to crowd attendance in the AFLW. Can you tell me what you found there?
Yeah. Good morning. Well, obviously, the AFLW launched with a bang in 2017, and certainly was incredibly well received in the starting years. Then a thing happened called COVID, and ever since COVID. Unfortunately, the numbers have gone down, both in terms of attendance and viewership on free-to-air broadcast. And I guess I can echo some of the comments of Moya in terms of the choices that you make as an organization. Do you take it 100% serious, and do you invest, and is there vision behind the investment, or is it more hoping that, you know, after a successful launch, you will continue to be successful?
A couple of weeks ago, we saw the GWS Giants come out saying they were disappointed by the lack of double headers between the men's and women's team. What do double headers do for a women's club fan base?
Well, I think the bigger picture really is, and I want to go back again to what Moya said about the product, you know, the product of female professional sport versus male professional sport, in particular in relation to football codes. You can't really say they are the same products, and therefore you also cannot treat them the same in terms of how you position them, how you market them. And to that extent, I think a double header is just a marketing tool to lift on the exposure that the male game already has, and therefore it is a tool to increase awareness and exposure of the female game and show to a public that maybe otherwise wouldn't go to an AFLW match what the quality of that match is, create a level of interest that makes people more likely to go to a standalone match. But a double header is really a step in the process towards more marketing exposure. But it is also a step in the strategy of creating an independent product that can stand on its own. And, you know, again, like Moya said, it may be promoted for different reasons to potentially different segments in the market, although there will be a great overlap as well. If you like the men's game, you also will like the female game for the amazing skills that the athletes perform on the field.
Moya, how have double headers worked with the A-League in Australia?
There've been a lot of double headers over the years in the A-Leagues, and they have served to introduce women's football to an audience that whose primary interest is men's football. But I think, as Hans said, it's a step to a different end game. There was some interesting segmentation work done by the WSL in England, and they concluded that they had three sorts of fans. They had the hardcore women's football fans who were like rusted on forever. There were the what they called secondary fans who started with an interest in men's football and then got a kind of a side interest in women's football, but it's a secondary thing for them. And there are a lot of those fans in England, as you can imagine. If you're a fan of Arsenal or Chelsea or Liverpool, you might take an interest in their women's team. And then there were the newbie fans who were relatively new to the game and did not come from men's sport. They were just fans of women's sport. And actually, all three segments there make up their audience. So I'm sure you'll find something very similar in Australia. Double headers are useful to expose the game to an existing audience, but I think we should be more ambitious than that. We should be looking to get new fans who are different and who will grow the overall market. That makes a lot of sense for an integrated club to do that.
Hans, your research has also looked at how good investment in the professional codes flows onto grassroots community support. What do we know?
Well, first of all, I think a general statement here is that both in terms of professional leagues and major events, there's not a direct correlation between being exposed to the elite game and people starting to play. Certainly not with pulsating events like the Olympics. You know, there might be a little spike after an event like that, but it doesn't really lead to ongoing engagement. So it really is important that those clubs that have elite parts to their clubs or indeed leagues that are professional leagues, those that are integrated with community sport are the ones that are most likely to be successful because they can provide a whole supply chain all the way from grassroots development programs to attendance and viewership at the pro part of the game. And I think, you know, if we take the AFL as an example, in the initial foundation of the national game, the AFL, they kind of separated the elite part of the game from grassroots, and only down the track started realizing if you don't invest in the grassroots, then you also don't have an elite product. So it's less a top-down approach, and it's more a bottom-up approach. Mm. In that, you know, if you don't feed your community sport system, then you know your elite part of the game will suffer as well. And just allow me to quickly sidestep to an emerging sports system such as India, where really there's hardly any community organized sports, certainly not the beautiful systems that we have in Australia and many European countries, club-based community sport. If you start a pro league, then you only have a pro league.
Yeah.
And if there's no infrastructure at the community level to start feeding, you know, young people into the system that ultimately will go and play in your pro league, then the system's still not complete. So I think the most important observation here is that you cannot separate the top from the bottom.
Mm. Kate says on the text line, I was chatting to a dad from the opposing girls team at my daughter's under 13 soccer game about women's sport. And he says he's now women's sport so good, he often prefers it. Kate says, as a middle-aged woman, I never would have dreamt my daughter could play local club soccer, especially in a girls team. So Moya, it really does sound like women's sports are really helping boost engagement at the grassroots level.
Grassroots sport in Australia, and especially football, it goes gangbusters. I mean, there are just so many people who want to play that there aren't enough facilities to hold them. It's actually a challenge to find the spaces to play. I think the thing that has made the big difference, though, for the Matildas over the last decade is that there has been an emerging pathway into professionalism, so that instead of being, you know, part-time players or amateur players, as I was when I was in the Matildas, you know, you work 5 days a week, you go to train in the evenings and you play on the weekends. And, you know, these days the Matildas are full-time professionals playing in professionalised clubs in good daily training environments with good coaches, you know, good dietitians, psychologists, etc. And they're playing in professional leagues. And that, you know, becoming a full-time athlete is the key to the phenomenal growth in their performance, I think. So it's actually building out the pathway from the grassroots through to professional clubs and leagues and then into, you know, onto the world stage.
Moya Dodd is former vice-captain of the Matildas and current secretary to the board of the Women's League Forum. And Hans Vesterbeek, professor of international sport business at Victoria University.
Listen to more great stories that take you beyond the headlines. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.